Just give me your part.
All right. Okay.
Good.
I think I'm good.
Okay. I would like to welcome Tracy.
Thanks, everybody. Now, I have one of those voices that usually isn't hard to hear all the way to the back of the room, but I'm also a pacer, so I'm probably going to do some of this. So, Sarah, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yay! Sarah can hear me, so she doesn't have to be irritated anymore. I'm not going to say I was a last-minute addition, but this has, as Sherry has shared with you, this has been an experience in letting God take the role and show us what he wanted done. And I wasn't the first choice for a speaker for today. It was somebody else. And unfortunately, she's actually celebrating her 30-year anniversary, I think, this weekend, and couldn't be here with us. So then, a couple weeks ago, Sherry said, well, I have an idea for somebody else to come and speak to the group. And I was like, who? And she goes, you. She goes, actually, the way it happened is at one of the Saturday 8:30 meetings that I wasn't at, the group decided that they wanted me to speak. So, I struggled a little bit with this, not because I wanted to, I had any problems standing up and talking about my experience, strength, and hope, but because I had so much to say, and I got pretty emotional saying it, so I did write a lot of stuff down, because at my core, I'm a writer, not so much a speaker or a presenter. So I will be going off some of my notes today, but I'll also be going off topic too, probably. Doubtful that this is going to last a whole 30 minutes like you were promised, but that just leaves more time for sharing for all of us, right? And since there's so many of us, that's a good thing. So, let's get started. My name's Tracy, and I'm a compulsive reader. I walked into my first OA meeting, and it was the Saturday 10:30 meeting, on July 16, 2005. Weighing 232 pounds, a few pounds shy of my all-time high of 249 pounds. And I'd actually known about OA since 1982. Back in the early 80s, I lived in Wyoming, and I remember going through the newspaper, and I saw this Overeaters Anonymous meeting being advertised, and I was like, oh, that sounds like something I need to do, and I thought about it, and I thought about it, and then one day I decided I was going to go, and I mentioned to some family members that I was going to try this. And they laughed me out of the room. They laughed me out of the room. They told me I didn't need that. And in fact, I remember my dad at the time saying, whenever I lose a lot of weight, people just ask me if I'm sick. So, you look better with a few extra pounds on you. And so I was like, they probably said that because at the time I was like 145 pounds. And, to the outside world, I looked normal. But I knew better. I knew better. And I knew differently. And this is what I knew. I knew that my first compulsive bite had been when I was a toddler. And the first compulsive bite was when I climbed up in the medicine chest and I ate an entire bottle of baby aspirin. No safety child caps in those days. Because it was candy. It tasted sweet. And so I was always a climber, my mom said, and I climbed up there and I ate the entire bottle, and I vividly remember being taken to the emergency room and having my stomach pumped. And to this day, I cannot stand the taste of orange-flavored things. An orange, I'll eat an orange, but if you try and give me an orange-flavored candy, I won't do it. So then I became compulsive with other things. I became compulsive as a child with my desserts. I wanted the biggest piece of everything. I wanted the first piece. I wanted to make mine last longer than everybody else. And I can remember this as a small, small child. I would binge on candy and goodies at my grandma's house. Not when she was there, of course. When she wasn't there. And then I'd move all the pieces around in the candy dish to make it look like I hadn't eaten as much. I mean, I was doing this at the age of 5 and 6. So, it was bad. Now, I can remember, I do have a memory of not eating compulsively. And it's a really vivid memory. I could have only been about 3 years old, and I was sitting at the breakfast table with my mom, and I had a bowl of Captain Crunch in front of me. You know, who doesn't want, you know, sugary Captain Crunch? And I couldn't eat it, and I didn't want it, and I was just like, you know, picking at and that kind of thing. It's the last time I can remember not eating compulsively, because shortly after that, my mom and dad got divorced, and I didn't see my father again until I was 18 years old. And, you know, is it a coincidence that I started turning to food after that? I don't think so. I learned to dull the pain at a very early age, very early age. So I grew up, life got harder, and the disease got stronger as I got older. I've shared a litany of stuff with all of you who've been to meetings with me about some of the crazy shit I did with food, and it's going to sound familiar to you. You know, I'd buy goodies, I'd hide them, and I'd eat them on the sly, and at different points in my life, I would then throw them up. I'd eat treats meant for my husband's lunch and then replace them before he knew that they were gone. I'd throw food away, pull it back out of the garbage until I got smart enough to start putting it in the garbage disposal. And I was the queen of eating food in the car between point A and point B with nobody with me and disposing of the evidence before, you know, I got home. You know, I was the queen of that. I would stop someplace and get rid of all the evidence, get rid of the wrappers. So after my second daughter was born in 1982, I had a really successful run at losing weight. But the disease got really sneaky at that point. And I think I got down to around 125 pounds, and then that's when the bulimia really started for me. That's when I would binge and I would purge, and nobody knew it. I think my husband suspected, but he didn't say anything about it because at that point he was really in cahoots with me as far as keeping me at a certain size. So throwing up, at different periods of my life, I stopped the throwing up and then went to laxatives, and then I went to diet pills, then I went to exercise. So I did pretty much all of it to compensate for the secret binges that I was experiencing. And that pattern held true throughout my life. As soon as I'd get some weight loss success under my belt, the purging thoughts would take over. And I can tell you, honestly, I was a great dieter. I was good at it. I could do any diet on the planet for about 6 weeks. Nutrisystem, Jenny Craig, Diet Center, several times with the Diet Center, Juice Fest, my own concoctions. And I can look back at those times that I actually did maintain weight without dieting and doing all that crazy stuff. And what I can see now, and some of you I know have experienced this, is that I was just using another drug of choice. I was just doing other compulsive behaviors to replace the food. I still have the same living problems. I still wasn't allowing myself to feel the feelings. I still had emotional issues. I just used different drugs. But for me, all roads eventually led back to food, my favorite drug of choice. So even with all those experiences, you know, I was 20 years old when I first found out about OA. And, okay, I didn't walk through the doors until, 2005. So at that point, I was 43 years old. So 23 years later, you would have think that life and my experiences would have, you know, pushed me to my knees, and I came crawling into OA. That was not the case. I was on a diet when I walked through the doors the first time. I was on a diet. I wasn't quite at the end of my rope when I walked into OA for the first time. It would take almost 4 years and a couple nasty, nasty relapses. Relapses that saw me gain back all the weight that I'd lost in the program, and some more, and forced me onto medication for type 2 diabetes. So, yeah, that's a ball of fun. And you know, it was prior to my first relapse that I started really getting disillusioned with OA. And I wondered about talking about this today, but you know what? I'm going to put it out there because this was my experience, good or bad. I didn't see or hear a lot of honesty in the program about calling a relapse a relapse. In fact, I didn't hear people talking about relapse at meetings at all. And sometimes it would take months for somebody to admit that they were in free fall, you know, into the food, when it was obvious to everybody else at the meeting what was going on, but nobody would say anything to them. Nobody would approach them about it. And, you know, we didn't embrace it, at least in my experience. And I didn't get that. I didn't get that. And it didn't feel good to me, because my opinion was, if we were all addicts and recognized that perfectionism was a huge part of this disease, why weren't we talking about that? Why weren't we embracing it? Why weren't we looking at relapse as part of the process, not just the problem? So, you know, it was like, ooh, relapse is bad. Don't talk about relapse, you know. Ooh, yeah. And, of course, you know, the four-year-old in my head, you know, what I heard was that, not that relapse is bad, I heard, you're bad. Because, you know, when you're a four-year-old, you can't separate who you are from what you do. So, you know, if I'm in the food and I break my abstinence and that's considered bad, then I'm bad. And there was only a couple people during that time who would actually came up to me and said, I know how hard this is. And yeah, I went through the same thing, and nobody would talk to me about it either. It was rough. So now, could I have just been projecting some of my stuff onto other people? Maybe they were talking about relapse and I just wasn't hearing it. That's possible. That's entirely possible. But all the mystery about relapse kept me away for a long period of time when I was really having a lot of problems. So today, I believe that relapse is part of recovery. It's part of recovery. Relapse, you're not going to believe I'm going to say this, but relapse is a gift. It's a gift. It's a learning opportunity. And the bigger the relapse, in my experience, the bigger the lesson that needs to be learned. And that was the L on mine. For L, it was learn the lesson. Because there's a lesson to be learned from every relapse. Whether you call it a slip or a slide or a relapse, whether it lasts a day or a month or a year, there's a lesson to be learned in that. So, you know, for me, my program has been that I've ping-ponged between deprivation and overconsumption my entire life. Diet binge, repeat. You know, that's my cycle. And even today, I struggle to accept the fact that how I look and what I weigh is exactly how God wants me to look and exactly what God wants me to weigh, just for today. And I can tell you, it really pisses me off. It really pisses me off. And it was a couple weeks ago in this room when a good friend in OA said to me, because I was sharing this frustration of, I haven't lost a pound since Christmas. I was doing so well. And nothing, I'm doing everything right, and nothing's happening, and I'm not dropping the weight, and I'm really pissed off about it. And not only that, because my daughter's getting married in 6 weeks in California, and I'm going to see the ex and all the in-laws, and who wants to look good for that, right? So all this stuff. And she turned to me and she said, have you ever thought that maybe this is the weight God wants you to be at forever? And I wanted to smack her. I wanted to smack her, because you know what it was? It was truth. It was truth she was saying to me, is that maybe this is the way God wants me to look. Maybe, you know, up until the day I die, I will be 187 pounds. Maybe it is. Do I like it? No, I do not like it. Do I like it better than 242? Yes, I do. Because that was where I ended up after my last binge, was at 242 pounds. So I'm down 55 pounds, and that's a gift from God. That is a gift from God. But of course, I always want more. I want to be better. I want to lose more. And that's probably why I'm where I am today. What I know is that the reason God wants me to look this way, and the reason He wants me to be this weight, is because the physical and emotional pain that it causes me to be here is the only single thing that would ever motivate me in the entire world to be willing to change. It's the only thing that's painful enough for me. God knew, in His infinite wisdom, that the only way I can get her to listen is to put her through intense physical and emotional pain. That's the only way she's going to listen to me, and I'm going to do it through this. And, you know, I need to change the way I think, the way I live, the way I eat, the way I interact with God. And it's the only thing that he knew it would make me entirely ready to give up all my defects of character or to ask for him to remove those from me. So that's my story for right now. And we're supposed to be here talking about relapse prevention. And you're expecting some words of wisdom from me. And all I can do is share my experience, strength, and hope with you. And if you find pearls of wisdom today in what I say, you thank your higher power. Because it's the higher power is coming and giving you whatever the message is. It's not me giving you the message. It's your higher power. I'm just sharing my experience, strength, and hope. And so it has everything to do with you and your higher power and nothing to do with me. Okay? I was fortunate a few months ago to find my old journals, because when I first started in OA, I was a journaling fool, you know. I was writing in my journals all the time, and I was, of course I was obsessive about it. Of course I was putting my weight and how much I exercised and what my blood sugars were, what my blood pressure was. I mean, you know, I was obsessive about it, because that's who we are, right? That's what we do. We don't do anything normally. We do it obsessively, compulsively. But it's great now to go back. It's great now to go back and read those journals, because I'm not a journaling fool now, you know, and I'll admit that. But it's really a fascinating history, the last 5.5 years, and very telling. And what I can tell you is that for me, there's no such thing as a slip with sugar. Sugar is my drug of choice. I recreational sugar. And the slipping and sliding for me always starts weeks and months before the food actually hits my mouth. Always. And it's clear to see that in the journals. Very clear. The crazy thoughts always come before the food hits my mouth. And this is what they sound like. Well, I know it has sugar in it, but it's an energy bar and it's got protein in it, so that will balance it out. Or, but it's sugar-free, so, you know, I can eat it, so it's okay. Or, I'll just eat this one fill-in-the-blank. You know, it could be one M&M. It could be one whatever. And I can always trace these crazy thoughts back even further and to feelings and emotions that make me uncomfortable. And those feelings and emotions sound like, oh, I'm the fattest one in this room. I hate how I look. I'm bored. I'm tired. I'm exhausted. I'm lonely. I'm never going to get another job. I'm going to be stuck in this house forever. You know, whatever that thought or emotion is, those feelings can be traced back to my core belief about myself. So we hear, you know, let's trace it back. Absent, you know, a lack of abstinence, you know, eating something off my food plan, you know, starting to go into relapse, trace it back to the crazy thoughts, trace it back to the emotions I'm not handling or wanting to deal with, and that goes back right to my core belief about myself. And my core belief about myself as a compulsive overeater is that I'm not good enough. That's the bottom line. And excuse me if I get a little emotional about this. This is the part this is why I have this here, because, you know, when you walk around the world believing you aren't good enough, you start telling yourself all kinds of stories and start throwing a big old pity party for yourself. And for me, once the pity party starts, the crazy starts, the crazy thoughts start, and the crazy eating for me will soon follow. So that's, and if you read my journals, it just reads like a map of that. So 2 years ago in April, I gave up the recreational sugar. I've done this in fits and starts, you know, throughout my 5.5 years. But it, for some reason, and thanks to my sponsor working with me and really doing step work, it took. And, but I took it back. I took the sugar back in April of 2010. On a trip to Milwaukee, and it took me until July that year to kick it to the curb. And that's a fast turnaround for me on a relapse, because my prior two relapses had been long. So, you know, that was a mini one for me. And here's where I'm going to get really honest with you. 2 weeks ago, I started messing around with the sugar again. 2 weeks ago. So why am I up here talking to all of you about relapse? Or relapse prevention. I didn't want to. I wanted to call Sherry and tell her, I can't do this. I wanted my sponsor to tell me, you shouldn't do this. Because I felt like a fraud. It's why I didn't even type this up until 2 days ago. Okay? I didn't know what I was going to say to you until 2 days ago. Because I thought I didn't have any right to stand up here and tell all of you how to prevent relapse, because I see myself as the queen of relapse. And that's not what my HP wanted, though. No. My HP likes me humble. My HP likes me honest. So he said, no, you're going to get up there and you're going to tell your story and you're going to tell. You're going to be honest. You're not going to stand up there and pretend like everything's hunky-dory and life's great once you give up the sugar and, you know, you never look back, because that's not the way life is. Who better to talk about relapse than somebody who's fighting it right now? And I can tell you, for me, this is the face of desperation. This is the face of a woman on a slippery slope that leads to the hell that only you, other compulsive readers, can even imagine. So what led my slide down this slippery slope? You know, the details are numerous, and actually, it goes back to what I talked about in the beginning. You know, my core belief system of not being good enough kicked in again. You know, I've done a lot of work on that, but if it's, we talk about that peeling away the layers of the onion, and you know what? Another layer's got to be peeled back. And I started feeling sorry for myself. The negativity and the crazy thoughts began. And actually, this time, when the crazy thoughts began, they weren't about binging. They were about restricting. Restricting the food. I started thinking about going back on a diet again. You know, because that wedding's coming up in April. Oh my God, I got to fit into that dress. I got to look good. I got to wow them. I got to stun them. Right? Because some of these people I haven't seen in 10 years. And I started then concocting all kinds of things that I could do with my food myself. Okay, well, you don't need to go to Weight Watchers again. You could just do da-da-da. Eat this for breakfast, eat this for lunch, eat this for dinner. That makes me nuts. Makes me nuts. Makes me crazy. It really does. And maybe other, and I know there's other people that can come into OA and they can balance, you know, doing some kind of a meal plan like that with, you know, doing the program. And I say, all the power to them. You know, that's great. If I could do that, I would. I can't. I do believe that in this program, you know, our disease runs on a continuum of how sick we are. And thank God some people come in before they go too far down that continuum, you know, of illness, and they're able to stop it in its tracks right there. And they're probably the ones, I'm guessing, that probably can handle going to some kind of weight management program and getting the benefits of OA. Well, you all just heard that my first compulsive bite was when I was 3 years old, and it took me until I was like 44, 43 to get in here. So I had 40 years of sickness behind me. I was full-blown, all the way down, addict. Okay? I can't do that. And it took me 40 years to figure out, I can't do that. I have to do this. But once the compulsive thought started for me, whether it was restricting the food, and this is where I think we can all recognize this, whether we're anorexic or bulimic or compulsive overeaters in here, once the crazy thought started with the food, no matter what they were, the end was inevitable. The result was going to be inevitable. So how do I prevent a full-blown relapse? Two words. Step work. And I'm not minimizing the power of the tools, because the tools are what we use to help us do the step work. You know, I have a food plan, and I only mention it because some people want to know how I lost 55 pounds so far. And my food plan is 3 meals a day, 1 afternoon snack. I do that because of my blood sugars that I need to keep kind of stable throughout the day. No recreational sugar, and by that I mean desserts, candy, pastries, and yes, muffins and granola bars are dessert for me, okay? They're dessert for me. My husband just shakes his head. You know, if he ever sees me approaching a muffin, he goes, you know, that's just cake without the frosting. And he's right. It is just cake without the frosting. Who am I fooling? I know for a fact that if I go 2 weeks without going to a meeting, I am in big trouble. Big trouble, because my head's not in the game. My head's not in the game, and I'm probably not doing step work if I'm doing that. So meetings are important for me. Meetings are very important. Today was very important for me. The other things I do is I make calls. I provide service, even when I don't want to. I have a sponsor. I am a sponsor. But at the end of the day, for me, if I'm not doing step work, it's only a matter of time. It's only a matter of time until I'm going to slip and slide my way into full-blown relapse. And that's why I'm here now. That's why I'm here now. I've been avoiding my sponsor as she sits over there staring at me. We do have a meeting tomorrow, by the way. but, you know, I haven't met with her for at least a couple months, maybe more. And she keeps me accountable when it comes to my step work. I have to have something to report to her when we meet, right, about the work I've been doing. She keeps me accountable. She holds me accountable. Each time I got abstinent after a relapse, it was while I was doing step work. You know, you have to do the work and wait for the miracle to happen. You can't wait for the miracle and then be inspired to do the work. So every time, step work was what got me abstinent again. I was taking action. Isn't that our new tool? Action, action plan, plan of action. You know the old saying, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, okay? Well, this compulsive overeater's road to hell is paved with an action. I say it's paved with an inaction and insight, because I can come to meetings and I have wonderful insight about myself. Oh, I have so much insight. That's just, you know, light bulbs were going off. That never kept an ounce of food out of my mouth. Insight never kept an ounce of food out of my mouth. It was action, always action. And I do firmly believe if an addict isn't doing step work, it's only a matter of time. It's only a matter of time until relapse. Maybe it'll be 2 years, could be 2 weeks, 2 months, 2 days. If you're not doing step work, that's what I think. Now, the other thing that's helped me too, and I will put the plug in here for a good therapist, okay? Sponsors are necessary, and they're awesome, and you need a sponsor to work this program. But they aren't therapists, and if there's some deep emotional work that needs to be done, you're probably going to need, I needed, the help of a professional. And when this crazy kind of thinking starts happening, I know it's time for me to go back in for 2 or 3 sessions, just to get my head on straight. I got an appointment with her next week. You know, for me, when the crazy thoughts start, that's a red flag that says, whew, you need help, you need help. And that means sponsor help, that means getting to meetings help, that means going and talking to your therapist help, because I know that when I start having those crazy thoughts, it's because that core belief of I'm not good enough has been reactivated for whatever reason. It's been reactivated. So I work with a woman who gets that food is an addiction. She gets that. And she completely respects the 12-step program of recovery. I couldn't work with somebody who didn't get that. So I'm really blessed in that. The other thing that's key for me, and you're not going to want to hear this one, for remaining abstinent is exercise. Exercise. Yes, exercise, the word that many of us don't like to hear. Hell, I don't like to hear that word, okay, especially at 4:30 in the morning when I have to get up. But there's something that happens to me when I exercise, and I don't understand it, but I've come to accept it. And I guess it's because for me, I spent most of my life not in my body, not grounded in my body. Somewhere out here, that's why I was always so clumsy, bumping into people, tripping things, running into walls, because I wasn't in my body, you know, for various reasons. You know, I felt uncomfortable, and I just didn't appreciate it, and I just wasn't at ease, you know, in this body. I was just never, never at ease in it. But exercise is kind of like magic for me. Not that it makes it easier to do, but it is kind of like magic. It makes me feel better about my body no matter what size I am. And that's just been a truth for me, whether I was almost 250 or whether I've been 150, exercise made me feel better about my body. Because I can feel horrible at my body, that's the other thing, at any size, at any weight. It's like there's something spiritual that happens for me. And I can actually focus and meditate when I'm moving. And I call it my moving meditation. And I'm one of those people, probably have some ADD, can't sit still, can't stand still, have to walk around in pace. But for me, when I exercise, it really tends to clear that channel between me and my higher power. And I get my best ideas and I do my best thinking when I'm exercising. And I've noticed that I'm much more likely to make healthy choices with food and to be in a better mood when I exercise in the morning. And like I said, does that make it easier to get up? No. Have I been doing that the past couple weeks? No. Did I this morning? Yes. Yes. You know, back when I first moved to the Omaha area, and that was 2002, because I lived in Wyoming. I lived for 18 years in Northern California, and then I moved back to Nebraska. And some people say, why did you do that? Long story, another story for another day. But now I'm kind of stuck here. So we're going to make the best of it. But I used to work with domestic abuse survivors. And we talk about that dynamic of how a woman will go back to her abuser over and over again. And, you know, those women would be really hard on themselves. And they would say, how could I be so stupid to do it again? And, you know, I would be the one to try and gently tell them, you know, it's leaving an abusive relationship is a process. It's not an event. And I would tell them, I thought this was an inspired idea at the time, I said, it's kind of like going on a diet. I'd say, do you know anybody who's gone on a diet one time, done it perfectly, and never had to do it again? And I would say to them, leaving an abusive relationship is very much like that. Each time you do it, you get a little wiser, you get a little smarter, you plan a little better, and someday you'll leave for good. Someday. And it strikes me now that I can use the same analogy when talking about OA and my food addiction. You know, I'm my own abuser. Food is my weapon that I use against myself. Every time I go back to the food or relapse, I get a little smarter, a little wiser, and I learn something new about myself every time. And it drives home the lessons that I have to learn over and over again. And maybe they're not your lessons, but they're my lessons. My lessons are be honest and be humble and be the imperfect human being that God meant you to be. And love yourself the way you are today. And I'm surprised I got through that without crying, frankly. Okay. To close up, on page 315 of the For Today, I don't know if anybody has one with them, but there's a quote by Ralph Waldo Emerson, page 315. And it says, whatever games are played with us, we must play no games with ourselves, but deal in our privacy with the last honesty and truth. Whew, okay, this one's a little emotional. In the most private of moments, my honesty and truth is this. I'm a compulsive overeater. Now and forever. And forgetting that truth for a single second puts me in danger. And what got me honest in the past is what I have to use every single day. And without honesty, there's no abstinence. And without abstinence, I will not have any sanity. And in the end, that's what it's really all about.
And she thought she